today on Against the Grain, it was an unprecedented surge in Mexican migration to the U.S. But how much do we know about the lives migrants and their families led in the U.S. and back in Mexico? I'm C.S. The historian Ana Raquel Minian joins me to discuss her eye-opening book, Undocumented Lives, The Untold Story of Mexican Migration, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Too often, we learn about people who are in the news from the news and from stereotypes propagated by people or institutions with a bone to pick or an agenda to push. Mexican migrants to the U.S. Now, there is a population about which assumptions abound. Assumptions about their identities, their desires, their relationships, their ways of life. Ana Raquel Minian decided to go behind the assumptions, to meet and talk with people who migrated to the U.S. and the people they left behind in Mexico. Minian, a history professor at Stanford University, conducted over 250 oral history interviews on both sides of the border. What she discovered is set forth in her new book, Undocumented Lives, The Untold Story of Mexican Migration. When Ana Minian joined me recently in studio, I asked her what happened to undocumented Mexican migration to the U.S. between 1965 and 1986.
This was a period that saw the rapid rise of undocumented Mexican migration to the United States. Up until 1964, Mexico and the United States had a bilateral agreement through which Mexican workers could come and work for short periods of time in the United States legally and then return to Mexico. This program was called the Bracero Program, and workers would come to work in agriculture. In 1964, the U.S. Congress decides to end this program, and a lot of the Mexican men who had already become accustomed to coming to the United States and working here for short periods of time found that they could no longer do so. And so, if they wanted to keep on working north of the border, they had to come without papers. Because conditions in Mexico remained the same, many found that the best way for them to advance economically was to continue coming to the United States. And so they simply did so without papers. As such, in the years between 1965 and 1986, we see a rapid rise in the number of undocumented migrants who are coming from Mexico to the United States. Because it is so hard to estimate the number of people who came to the United States without documents, the number that is often used is the number of people who are apprehended by immigration officials. And that number rose from 55,000 in 1965 to over 1.5 million by 1986. That is a 3,000% increase.
What proportion of those who migrated were men? Now, of course, understanding that we don't have a lot of data on this, but what proportion of those who migrated were men and what proportion were married men?
Again, it's very hard to know exact numbers and figures vary, but according to some of the most reliable figures, more than two-thirds, much more than two-thirds, but that's the lowered number that has been given of undocumented migrants who were coming were men during this period. The vast majority of them were married.
Can you say a little more about the Bracero program? This officially lasted from 1942 to 1964. So this was men who were coming to the U.S. from Mexico to work in agriculture?
That's right. So when the United States joined the Second World War, American men started going overseas to fight, and there was a need for more workers in the United States. One of the ways to get more workers was to include more women in the workforce, but another was to import Mexican workers to work here legally. At first, Mexican guest workers were allowed to work in the railroad, But after a while, it became a program specifically dedicated to agriculture. So from 1942 to 1964, Mexico and the United States sign a series of bilateral agreements through which Mexican workers could come, work here for short periods of time, and then return to Mexico. And that series of bilateral agreements is what we now know as the Bracero program.
So in the time period that you address in your book, which is 1965 to 1986, what made Mexican men want to or need to leave Mexico for the U.S.?
Generally, we only think about economic reasons when thinking about migration. And economics played a very important role in driving men from Mexico to the United States. The states of highest out-migration from Mexico were the ones in the Central Plateau region in western central Mexico, which were often agricultural states. So when there were droughts, when people couldn't find work in agriculture because of new technological advancements that were taking jobs away from people, people started to migrate. But economics alone does not explain the phenomenon of undocumented migration or the rapid rise. First, we have to see at the Bracero program. The Bracero program already created a culture of migration. People became accustomed to coming to the United States through the Bracero program. When Braceros returned to Mexico, they had brought new clothes, they had brought money to build homes, they had brought a sense that people could go to the United States to improve their economic situation. They had also come to understand life in the United States and come to be attached to it. So ending the Bracero program seemed to policymakers in the United States as a solution to simply end migration. But the culture of migration had already been created. And so after 1965, all that needs to happen is a change towards a new culture of undocumented migration, which develops very quickly. In the years from 1965 to 1986, men start to be pressured by their own communities to migrate. As such, this culture of migration no longer remains a part only of those who have migrated themselves, but now entire communities in Mexico start to understand that if they want to improve their socioeconomic status, they need to send or encourage men to go to the United States. Families know that if they want to build homes, if they want to have better clothes, if they want to have access to things that they do not currently have, the best way to do so is for someone in the family to go north. And that someone is expected to be the man, the husband, the father of children, the man of the family is supposed to be the one who goes to the United States. So these men start to feel a lot of pressure to go north.
And you are suggesting that it's not just pressure from families. There's a kind of community pressure or social pressure as well for men to leave Mexico and go to the U.S.?
Absolutely. As I was doing this research, I conducted over 250 oral history interviews, both with people who migrated and with many people who remained in Mexico. And both the people who remained in Mexico and the people who migrated described that communities in Mexico, especially these communities of very high out-migration, pressured the men to go north. So, for example, a lot of men said that if they hadn't gone to the United States, their friends would have mocked them and considered them cowardly or considered them not to be masculine enough because they weren't supporting their families. So it became a real rite of passage to go to the United States for men.
Interesting. So are you saying that many men would have actually preferred to stay in Mexico but left because of the pressure they felt from family and friends and society?
Absolutely. A lot of men knew that going to the United States, even in the years between 1965 to 1986, implied a very high risk at the border. People were already dying while crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. Many men simply didn't want to have to face that risk. Moreover, Leaving and going to the United States meant saying goodbye to loved family members, to children, to mothers. It also meant living in a society that they knew would consider them primarily as quote-unquote illegal aliens rather than as people. So they knew the costs of going to the United States. Of course, many men also were seeking adventure and wanted to explore a new land. They had heard about the United States. They saw their friends migrating. They knew all that they could acquire by migrating. And so they were excited to do it so. But they were pressured, and many felt this pressure. The two cannot necessarily be separated from one another.
Did these men, and as you said, the vast majority were married, and that makes sense because married men had to provide for their families, and if they couldn't find work in Mexico, they might have felt more pressure to go from, as you said, wives and other family members. Did most of these men, once they reached the U.S., did they stay permanently in the U.S.?
No, during the years between 1965 to 1986, just as beforehand during the Bracero program, men came to the United States, stayed here for a short period of time, and then returned to Mexico. Most migrants did not want to settle in the United States. They knew that their families were back home in Mexico and they wanted to be with them. Not only that, but the very families that had pressured men to go north then insisted that they return with money to be with them in Mexico. So the pattern, the culture of migration that developed was not the one that we see now, in which migrants come and try to settle permanently in the United States, but rather it was a culture in which it was understood that men would go to the United States, work here, make some money, return to Mexico, see their family members, and if they needed money again, they would simply head back north at a later date. This is a phenomenon that is known as circular migration, where rather than going and staying in a new place, migrants would come and go between the two countries.
That's Ana Raquel Minian. She's assistant professor of history and of comparative studies in race and ethnicity at Stanford University, and she's author of Undocumented Lives, The Untold Story of Mexican Migration. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Okay, so if families and friends expected these men to return to Mexico, to engage in a kind of circular migration, what about the governments of the U.S. and of Mexico? What were their expectations as far as how often or the patterns of migration that these men should follow?
Both the Mexican government and the U.S. government knew that most migrants engaged in circular migration rather than staying permanently in either country. For the Mexican government, this pattern of circular migration was a way in which government officials knew that if men went north, made money in the United States, and came back to spend that money, they knew that it could benefit Mexico's economy. On the one hand, unemployment was reduced. Unemployed men, or even more importantly, underemployed men, were going away rather than trying to seek work in Mexico, and then they were coming back with money. So this allowed, or they perceived this as a way for Mexico's economy to grow. All they needed to do was to turn a blind eye and allow men to continue going north like they were already doing. But this was something that they saw positively. On the other hand, in the United States, politicians also had studies detailing that most Mexican migrants came to the United States and then returned to Mexico. And yet, the rhetoric that was developed in the United States was one that did not take into account this circular type of migration. Instead, U.S. officials, the U.S. media, and popular belief seemed to convey an image of Mexican migrants coming and staying in the United States on a permanent basis, abusing the welfare system, taking jobs away from citizens, sending money through remittances back home rather than also taking money back home because they're leaving. So there was this belief that the population of undocumented people living in the United States was actually growing exponentially. And if you only see the number of apprehensions that I mentioned earlier, whereby in 1965, 55,000 people were being apprehended, and by 1986, 1.5 million people were being apprehended, you would believe that the number of undocumented immigrants who are living in the United States is growing extremely rapidly. But actually, during this period, in the years between 1965 and 1986, 86% of men who came to the United States, of all migrants, but most of them were men, as we've said, returned to Mexico. So 86% were leaving on an annual basis, which meant that the growth rate of undocumented migration was much lower than the apprehension rates would suggest. And yet, in the rhetoric that was conveyed about undocumented migrants during these years in the United States, this was not conveyed. What was conveyed was a strong fear that the undocumented population was growing rapidly.
What about Mexican women? So many of their husbands are going to the U.S. to find work and to make money and to send it home or maybe to bring it home. The women who were left behind by, let's say, these husbands, were they in any way expected or encouraged to migrate to the U.S.?
Actually, they were discouraged from migrating to the United States. Many women that I talked to in Mexico described that they would have loved to come to the United States. They missed their husbands. They figured their husbands were seeing all these new places that these women could not see. They wanted to have that opportunity too. And yet, their husbands often discouraged them from going north alongside them. And they did so for multiple reasons. First, there was a widespread belief in Mexico that once women crossed the U.S.-Mexico border, they would become much more sexually promiscuous and would cheat on their husbands. So husbands often forbade their wives from heading north. Similarly, parents of single women believed that their daughters would become sexually promiscuous in the United States and also try to prohibit them from going north. But that's only one angle. Alongside that is the fact that crossing the border was an extremely expensive endeavor because migrants had to pay for their smugglers, known as coyotes. And this was very expensive. Life in the United States was also much more costly than it was in Mexico. So it was very hard in terms of cost for one person in the family to go to the United States and almost impossible for a whole family to migrate. So according to the gender ideologies in Mexico, the belief was that the man should go north to make money while the women stayed in Mexico taking care of the children. And one final factor that discouraged women from wanting to go to the United States was this rampant sexual abuse that occurred at the border and the rumors around these dangers. So in towns of high out-migration, women talked and gossiped among each other about a particular woman who had gone north and had been raped by her coyote or by the border patrol. And these stories that circulated widely in towns in Mexico discouraged many women from wanting to take the journey north.
What conventional views of Mexican women and their propensity to, you know, migrate to the U.S. to give birth does all this information you're giving me push back against?
Well, in the United States during this period, a stereotype developed of Mexican women wanting to come to the United States to have their children here. And this was done for many reasons. One of the reasons this stereotype developed was around the idea of, well, if the woman comes and has her child here, she'll be able to become a U.S. citizen, what is now known as the anchor baby phenomenon. So that stereotype developed around the 1970s. The other idea was that women would have much more access to welfare if they had U.S.-born children. So these two ideas grew during the 1970s and 1980s, But actually, what we see during this very period is that women stayed in Mexico, preferred to have their children in Mexico, and that it was men, married men alone, who went north. Women themselves often describe that one of the reasons that they didn't want to have children in the United States was because they didn't like the culture here. They believed that the United States was, again, a place of promiscuity, and they didn't want their children to grow up around that culture, a place where children took drugs, and they preferred life in Mexico.
So one might expect that, you know, you have these Mexican towns and cities, and the men, you know, significant numbers of men are departing for the U.S. So the women are left to themselves in a sense, and that might open up their lives and give them more autonomy so that they can be freer or feel freer to engage in activities that maybe they wouldn't if they were in a traditional family structure with a husband present. What did you find?
Actually, that was one of the most surprising things that I found during my research, because when I first started, that's exactly what I expected to find: towns in which feminism could flourish as a result of women becoming predominant in the hometowns. There were hometowns that I visited in Mexico where the majority of the people living there consisted of women, children, the elderly, and some queer people, but men of reproductive age had gone to the United States. So I had expected that in these communities, women would be able to gain much social and economic power. What I found was the exact opposite, especially in the state of Michoacán, which was the state of highest out-migration during these years. And what I found was that women started to fear being accused of being unfaithful to their husbands who were away in the United States. Women described that before their husbands migrated in such increasing numbers, the men were already controlling them, but not to the same extent that they started to control them once they were away in the United States. Once men were far from women, they had no direct control over them. And yet they used other means of control. And because their fears increased that women were being unfaithful to them, their need to control them actually increased. So for example, women would often move in with their parents-in-laws while their husbands were away in the United States. And husbands and parents-in-laws agreed that women should not be allowed out of the house to socialize in the town. So the women's parents-in-laws prevented their daughter-in-law from going out too much. A lot of women described that they felt that in their parents-in-law's house, they felt imprisoned. This was the term that was constantly repeated by women, that they felt imprisoned.
And the in-laws were specifically worried that the women, by going out and socializing, might be unfaithful?
That's right. That was the big fear. It was like, look, the husband's not here. What's going to happen? The woman is going to go out, meet another man, and cheat on our son. And so they would try to prevent her from meeting other men by keeping her indoors. But often, women themselves try to refrain from going outdoors too much, because in town, people would start to gossip that those who were outside, those who did socialize in town, those who were seen moving around too much in the streets, were being sexually promiscuous and cheating on their husbands. Women said that these women who were seen outside too much were called muy callejeras, which translates to being outside too much in the street, but also has the connotation of being unfaithful and promiscuous. Women themselves started to regulate each other's behaviors. So if they saw their neighbors walking around the street or talking to someone, they would start gossiping And women feared this gossip and so started to refrain from going outdoors. They often feared this gossip because they knew that rumors of their infidelity or of their presumed infidelity, of them being outside too much, would ultimately reach their husbands, who threatened women that they would stop sending remittances if they were seen outside. So men could control women from the United States to Mexico just through the power of gossip. And the actual enforcers of this control were other women who believed that it was okay for women not to be going outside too much.
I'm C.S. Song. My guest is Ana Raquel Minian. She's assistant professor of history and of comparative studies in race and ethnicity at Stanford University. And we are talking about her new book. It's called Undocumented Lives, The Untold Story of Mexican Migration. So we've talked about married men. We've talked about women, the women who were left behind, the wives who stayed in Mexico. You also bring up in your book the situation of queer Mexican men. So to what extent were they expected or encouraged to migrate to the U.S. in the period that you cover in this book, which is again between 1965 and 1986?
Queer men were the only men that I found who did not feel the pressure to migrate that most men faced. And there were many reasons why they didn't. The first one was because they did not have a family, and supporting the family was the primary reason why heterosexual men migrated. As a result, queer men could simply stay in Mexico and not risk their lives at the border. Similarly, they were not pressured by their friends to go north because they had already lost that masculine privilege. Their femininity implied that, like women, they would stay in Mexico. Equally important, queer men were able to find jobs that heterosexual men found unattainable or unappealing. For example, a lot of restaurant owners claimed that they preferred to hire queer men over heterosexual men because there was always the risk that a heterosexual man would molest or harass the female patrons that attended the restaurant, while he could fully trust that the queer men would not. Not only that, heterosexual men often refrained from taking jobs that were perceived as being feminine because they did not want to lose their masculine privilege. For example, queer men were able to take jobs such as being florists or being hairdressers, while heterosexual men had to work in agriculture. Working in agriculture meant that if there was a drought, men were left with little opportunity to stay in their hometown and often decided to migrate. Alternatively, queer men who could take these jobs, such as florists or hairdressers, found that not only could they take these jobs, but they were actually paid more than women for taking them. According to the stereotypes that existed at the time, queer men were seen as being particularly creative and detailed. So while women could also put floral shops or could also be hairdressers, people preferred to employ the services of gay men and so paid more for them because of this belief that they would do a better job. As a result, gay men managed to make enough money that they did not have to go to the United States.
One might expect gay men to want to migrate or to migrate in order to escape discrimination in their home communities.
Absolutely. The widespread belief is that gay men would be the first people to jump and come to the United States, to jump at this opportunity to be in a seemingly more liberal country and escape their Catholic small communities. But actually, queer men described that they had enough sexual opportunities in Mexico and that their life could flourish as gay men without the need to come to the United States. In fact, many felt safer back at home. In the United States, they did not know the laws, but they knew that it was somehow illegal to be gay, although they did not know explicitly how that was so. And they also knew that they would be undocumented. So many would say, well, if I went to the United States and try to have sex with a heterosexual man who didn't want it, he would call the cops on me. And not only could I be arrested, but I could also be deported. And there were a lot of fears around being undocumented and gay at the same time. Meanwhile, in Mexico, they did not have to have those fears. If anything, a lot of people described that they were ridiculed for being gay, but that this ridicule was not enough pressure to risk their lives at the border and then to live as undocumented gay men in the United States.
Were gay men at more danger than straight men at the border upon crossing the border?
Because a lot of gay men were seen as similar to women, and often heterosexual men had sex with queer men and saw them simply as a sexual outlet similar to women. So a heterosexual man could have sex with a gay man without being considered gay himself. As a result, at the border, many gay men, like women, were sexually abused by their smugglers, by their coyotes. Not only that, if they were apprehended in the United States, they would often face trouble in detention centers. This was so much the case that Leonel Castillo, who was then the Immigration and Naturalization Service commissioner, separated gay men from heterosexual men, quote unquote, for the protection of these gay men, because there was so much danger that they faced north of the border in detention centers of being sexually abused.
Her name is Ana Raquel Minian. That's M-I-N-I-A-N. She is assistant professor in the Department of History and the Center for Comparative Studies in Race and Ethnicity at Stanford. And her new book is Undocumented Lives, The Untold Story of Mexican Migration. We'll take a short break and speak more with Ana about her very interesting book. Please stay with us. And you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Ana Raquel Minian joins me. She is assistant professor of history and of comparative studies in race and ethnicity at Stanford. And her new book is Undocumented Lives, The Untold Story of Mexican Migration. It's published by Harvard University Press. I'd like to take a step back here. We've been talking about a lot of specifics, I think very interesting specifics, and your book is very good at kind of delving deep into the lives of people both in Mexico and in the U.S. Why do you think it's so important to understand the private lives, the sometimes intimate lives of migrants?
Generally, when we think about migration, we think about these broad forces that push migrants to leave their hometown or that encourage them to come to the United States or to other countries. But looking at migrants' private lives does a couple of things. First, it shows that it's not only structural reasons that push people to migrate, but also their intimate lives, the pressure that they receive from their family members, from their friends, the idea that if they go, they can come back with money and support everyone at home. But I think that another important reason of understanding migrants' intimate lives and who they are is that migrants are often cast as stereotypes. People who come, who abuse welfare, people who take jobs, people who are extremely poor and have to leave, people who are being abused. And exploring migrants' in a much more complex and humane way, to fully understand them as human beings, allows us to see that they're much different from these stereotypes, and what they're contributing to society on both sides of the border is different from what we believe is happening.
And what was happening, of course, too, these men who were moving to the U.S., relocating to the U.S., was exposure to new places and new spaces. This is transnational movement, and some people might associate a kind of cosmopolitanism with this movement and these new experiences in new locations. What do you have to say about that, the extent to which this experience was a kind of reinforcement or maybe an introduction of cosmopolitanism into these men's lives?
On one hand, that is absolutely true. Men came, left their hometown, saw a new country, saw new buildings, ate new food, sent letters back home, often describing everything that they were seeing and experiencing. So in some ways, it did create a sense of cosmopolitanism on both sides of the border, in migrant communities on both sides of the border. But on the other hand, what is extremely surprising is that migrants themselves describe that rather than experiencing migration as an opening up of their space, they actually saw their sense of space become reduced as a result of the migration. So when they were in their hometowns, they felt the pressure to migrate. And many described this pressure as if their hometowns were shrinking in around them and pushing them out, squeezing them to leave. In other words, they felt that their sense of home was smaller rather than bigger. Similarly, once in the United States, many migrants described that their sense of space became curtailed even more. While in Mexico they could move freely, in the United States, migrants became very fearful of being apprehended by immigration officials and deported. As a result, migrants often described that during the 1970s and 1980s, they went directly from their home to their work and back to their home. Others described that they started to know where immigration officials lingered, because during this period, immigration officials would often stand in particular places where they knew Mexican migrants moved through and just wait for them and ask them for their papers. So migrants became acquainted with the places where immigration officials would be and would simply try to avoid them. But what this meant was that they often had to take extremely circuitous routes to go from their jobs back home or from their homes to their jobs. In other words, their sense of space became, again, very diminished. They described dashing into their homes if they saw immigration officials, rather than being able to walk leisurely. Others described that they would only go out after 7 p.m. at night because they knew that that was when the immigration officials would retire and go home, or would sometimes risk going out on Sundays when, again, most immigration officials didn't work.
And this obviously was and is for people, undocumented people living in the U.S. today, very unpleasant. I mean, it must, if anything, increase the desire to at some point go back to their home country because of this sense of alienation and constant vigilance and anxiety about being caught and deported.
Absolutely. This sense of fear, the sense that they did not belong, which was enforced through these immigration efforts and raids to deport them, to apprehend and deport them, made them feel like they did not belong in the United States. Most migrants who came here knew that they would ultimately reside back in Mexico, or at least that's what they believed, and that's what they told themselves constantly, that they would ultimately end up living back home.
And as you stress in your book, the lack of a sense of belonging in the U.S. on the part of these Mexican migrants, this lack of sense of belonging also applied when they were in Mexico with family and friends, back with family and friends in their communities.
Right. Migrants describe their sense of belonging as being from neither here nor there, ni de aquí ni de allá. In Mexico, they felt pressured by their families and communities to head to the United States. And once they were north of the border, the very families who had encouraged them to go now pressured them to return to Mexico, and they found a community in which they were, for the most part, rejected. And so they felt that they could not belong permanently on either side of the border. They thus tried to create a life of circular migration in which they could find small reprieve and a sense of community and belonging, even in short periods, precisely through their circular migration.
Did the fear of not being able to re-enter the U.S., did that deter some migrants from returning to Mexico to visit their families and communities?
Up until 1986, the border wasn't as fortified as it would later become. And so even though it was very hard to cross the U.S.-Mexico border, and some people did die during this period, most migrants saw the U.S.-Mexico border as fairly porous. And so they knew, or they believed, that if they returned to Mexico to be with their families, or if they returned to Mexico because life in the United States simply became too hard, and then they needed to go back north to make money, they would be able to do so. The fear of the border did not dissuade most migrants from leaving the United States until 1986.
What does this all suggest to you about what ramping up and intensifying border enforcement on the part of U.S. authorities will do to people's settlement patterns, Mexican migrants' settlement patterns?
Well, what we saw that happened in 1986 was that before that period, before 1986, migration was generally a circular phenomenon. Most people who came to the United States eventually left. Most men did not fear that if they returned to Mexico, they would not be able to cross back north again if they needed to find work again. Now, in 1986, the U.S. Congress passed the Immigration Reform and Control Act. And one of the clauses of this act was that it made it much harder to cross the U.S.-Mexico border because it put a lot of money into border enforcement. Now, undocumented workers, people who wanted to continue coming to the United States, now had to think twice about this pattern of coming and going. Migrants who left their homes after 1986 came here and, rather than returning to Mexico, encouraged their wives and children to also migrate. Because these men knew that if they returned to Mexico, it would be very hard for them to come back to the United States. Smuggler fees became much pricier as a result of the fortification of the border. And trying to enter the United States became a much riskier process. People had to cross the border through more dangerous terrains where they often faced dehydration and snakes. As such, men who crossed the border no longer tried to come back to Mexico simply to do another trip. Instead, they decided to settle permanently in the United States. A population that had been known for its circular migration now became permanent immigrants in the United States. And not only that, but they also encouraged their families who had previously remained in Mexico to come north. This meant that the undocumented population in the United States rose dramatically.
So you tighten the border, and the consequence is, it may be an ironic consequence, you have more Mexican migrants living here permanently or trying to do so.
That's right.
Ana Raquel Minian is my guest in studio. She is in the Department of History and the Center for Comparative Studies in Race and Ethnicity at Stanford University, where she is assistant professor. And the book we are talking about is her new one. It's called Undocumented Lives, The Untold Story of Mexican Migration. My name is C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I also want to ask you about a chapter in your book that goes into what are called hometown associations, or maybe that's kind of the technical term for them. These are clubs in parts of the U.S. that do certain things for their hometowns back in Mexico. Maybe the way to get into this topic is to talk about the Club Social Guadalupe Victoria. It was formed in 1962 by Mexican migrants living in Los Angeles. Tell us about that club and what it did for the hometowns of these migrants.
The Club Social Guadalupe Victoria was the first Club Social, which is now known as Hometown Association, that existed and continued to exist and to change life in Mexico. So these clubs are organizations that were created to improve life in their hometown. In 1962, a group of migrants from the small community called Guadalupe Victoria, which is in the state of Zacatecas in central Mexico, got together in a small restaurant called Las Delicias that was owned by one migrant from this very community of Guadalupe Victoria. And as the men got together, as they did every Sunday, they started to talk about the needs of the elderly in the community. And they decided that they should not only be sending money back home to their family members in the form of remittances, but they should try to also collect money to send to the needy elderly in town. And this is how the Club Social Guadalupe Victoria first started. Members would get together, would organize small picnics at places such as Lincoln Park in Los Angeles, and would use the money that they collected at these picnics, because they would sell to themselves the food that they had cooked, they would use the money to send funds to the elderly in the town of Guadalupe Victoria. Little by little, this club grew in size and activities and funds. And many other clubs started to copy the example of the Club Social Guadalupe Victoria. And by the 1970s, a true club culture had developed in Los Angeles around the idea of raising funds to send money back to Mexican hometowns.
And now what they were doing, as you detail in your book, Undocumented Lives, is they were, in some cases, kind of taking care of the less advantaged in their hometown communities. Why did they do, like, why didn't they feel like local or federal authorities in Mexico would or could do this kind of function, perform this kind of function?
They believed that the Mexican government had a responsibility toward its people and to support its people. In fact, the very government itself, as part of its stance, proclaimed that it would advance the revolution that had occurred in Mexico and make it institutionalized and help to support the working class. Despite the government's promises, it was not in fact acting as a welfare state that it proclaimed itself to be. When I interviewed activists, they told me it is the government's responsibility to help people, to bring things such as potable water and light to communities, electricity to communities, but they weren't doing it, so we had to intervene.
And in this context, you use the term extraterritorial welfare state. What's that?
Migrants came to believe that they were taking on the role of the government. The government proclaimed itself to be a welfare state, and it was failing to do so. And so migrants themselves started to act as a type of welfare state, but not from Mexico itself, but from Los Angeles. And so they started to function as a type of extraterritorial welfare state, not as the government itself, because they weren't taking control of all government actions, for example, policing, but they were taking care of what they believed to be the welfare needs in their communities. But their welfare needs were expansive. Although we generally think about welfare simply as aid, for example, helping the needy, migrants soon realized that this was not enough. People in their communities needed paved streets. They needed the schools to be fenced. They needed a health clinic. They needed potable water. And they introduced all this sort of infrastructure that is not generally considered part of a welfare system. They raised money to bring all these things to their hometowns as part of their vision of what welfare meant. Welfare for them meant ensuring that everyone in town had their basic needs satisfied. And this included electricity. This included potable water. People in Mexican towns themselves started to see hometown associations as being much more effective than the government itself. As such, these organizations, in fact, came to take the role of a type of extraterritorial welfare state.
And taking that role, did that involve or entail some kind of taking of political power?
At first, politicians ignored club activities. Club members would often request government help, and the government often would refuse to even pay attention to them. Now, as the clubs became much more important and they started putting a lot of money into these communities, think about it, they introduced potable water in some communities, they brought electricity to others. As they became much more important, government officials could no longer ignore them. In 1986, Zacatecas governor, Genaro Borrego, realized that the clubs were so important that if he wanted to have power, he needed to take into account the clubs. And so he actually reached out to them and created a program by which the state government of Zacatecas would give a dollar for every dollar that migrant clubs sent for the betterment of the state. In 1999, the federal government also realized that it could no longer continue to ignore club activities. And so in 1999, a new program is developed called the 341, by which the federal government of Mexico, each state government in Mexico, and the municipal government in Mexico to which the funds are sent, each of these governments puts a dollar for every dollar that migrants send for the betterment of their communities. As such, it's known as the programa 3x1 or 3x1.
That's the voice of Ana Raquel Minian, again, M-I-N-I-A-N, assistant professor of history and of comparative studies in race and ethnicity at Stanford University. And we've been talking about her book, Undocumented Lives, The Untold Story of Mexican Migration. It's published by Harvard University Press. Ana, thank you for writing this book, and thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.